Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Papa gave us this wonderful chant, and from Papa to Mother and Mother to us. It's a means to connect with God, to feel His presence. From my first hearing of it, it grabbed hold of me. And I began to chant it, whether I was driving or going someplace, walking, doing most anything, I would chant this chant. And I began to feel such a peace, such a stillness, such upliftment and bliss. Bliss is like, unlike any other emotion or feeling that we might have. We can have happiness, we can have enjoyment, but bliss originates in the spine. It's purifying, it's uplifting. It takes us beyond the things of this world and time and space and puts us into direct contact with God. So this is a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to cultivate in our minds. Now there are many paths to God. And we also have our Kriya Yoga. We have Hong Sa. One thing I noticed with Hong Sa, it had a very initially different kind of feeling to it. It was very quiet, very indrawn, where the Om Shri Ram was very blissful and uplifting and a somewhat different way. They take you to the same goal eventually. And so it depended on what my mood was and what effect appealed to me most, whether I wanted that deeply indrawn, peaceful state or that uplifted, blissful state. Both are God. Both are purifying. Both can take you all the way to the goal. So let us think on those things of the mind, our tendency of the mind. What does it have? What is it drawn to naturally? And when we find that our pole star, that the magnet of God is stronger than the magnet of this world, then we will naturally be drawn into that deepest state. The posting from this morning is entitled, The Greatest Treasure Imaginable. Carl and I have wheels under us once again, this time moving south, after a wonderful stop in Ashland where I met with aspirants and we had potluck followed by service. We continued our way 1,200 miles to Indio, California. It is here that my brother, who recently left the body, had an RV space at a deluxe park. Parked a few spaces away are motorhomes that are worth more than $2 million each. As you might imagine, the grounds are most impressive. Ponds and waterfalls, grassy stretches with bougainvillea, petunias, and roses in prolific bloom. We have come to stay until the new owners take possession. Meanwhile, we are cleaning and preparing the space. The summers have a generous amount of dust and cobwebs to be hydro-washed, thoroughly swept and polished. It is interesting to meet the neighbors who come down for the winter months. A friendly, pleasant lot, each with kind condolences for my brother. After being here for a few days, it struck me this morning how there is a vibration of materialism here. People naturally thinking of keeping their lots and machines in good condition and repair, but more than that, the topics of conversation about their lives and the lives of children and grandchildren, travel, etc. Fairly normal and nothing offensive at all. However, I have been used to talking with those involved in the spiritual path, and while ordinary topics are part of the conversations with devotees, there is always a subtext of lives being primarily focused on realizing God. And what a difference it makes It opens the world to something much larger, more meaningful than simple existence. It is interesting to hear how grandparents took their children and grandchildren to South Africa for a safari and touring. Interesting to a point. Then the interest wanes as there is nothing more, nothing for the spirit. Their joy of being with their grandchildren and enjoying their excitement is wonderful, meaningful. However, it does not go deep enough. It is a reminder of the vast difference in quality the spiritual journey makes in life. The real change in leading a spiritual life is connected to an existence above this world. For the devotee, whatever happens in duality, there's an unchanging supremacy of existence whose happiness and bliss is independent of ordinary life. The crucial difference is incorporated into the aspirant, woven into the fabric of his or her being to fulfill the greatest potential. Spiritual practice keeps the devotee from falling into ordinary humdrum existence. Meditation is the touchstone to this higher existence. Giving your life over to God transforms you into being a conscious participant of divine unfoldment. Ultimately, through the continual focus of the mind on God, you become an expression of divine consciousness, knowing it is He alone who thinks, speaks, and acts through you. Now the world stands revealed as made up of nothing but God stuff. However, on the way up to this exalted state of awareness, you stand with feet in two worlds, one with one foot in material existence, the other in the awareness of God's presence. It is in this sometimes tenuous in-between state that you become, that you must demonstrate the utmost integrity, not slide into forgetfulness of divine awareness. You live in this world. You fully participate in it. You share your concern for its well-being. Yet, you never forget the core of who and what you are in God. That must come first, the world second. You know that in seeking out God first, it is also for the highest good of the world. However, the world oftentimes does not share that view, so it makes its demands on you. In the process, you must choose. Situation by situation, you are tested to put God first. We are richly privileged to be living this spiritual life, with the highest teachings and the greatest examples of fully realized masters to guide our way. And in living this life, we are each day tested to put God first, to love Him most. Let us ever keep this lofty goal uppermost in mind. Tread this path with firm steps, never wavering or faltering. The greatest happiness and spiritual wealth is with us now. It is our greatest treasure imaginable. The Gospel of Ramakrishna is one of the beautiful works of a great, great soul that is recorded by another great soul, Master Mahasaya, whom we can read about in the Autobiography of a Yogi. In this book, Master Mahasaya meets Ramakrishna for the first time. Master Mahasaya, that is, has been trained in Western philosophy. He is a teacher and has been Westernized to a great extent. They come, he and a friend, originally to Dakshineshwar to look at gardens that are there. And he quite unexpectedly meets Ramakrishna, just stumbles upon a meeting that he's having with a small group of people and sits down and listens. And he is astounded. And so we begin when he first is meeting the master. I think this is the second meeting. Ramakrishna asks him about Western philosophy and Western logic. And so Master Mahasaya gives a fairly dry dissertation on English logic that deals with inductions and deductions. Ramakrishna's mind wanders while he is talking in this way, and so the conversation doesn't go far. Then we begin our narrative. When the meeting broke up, the devotees sauntered in the temple garden. Master Mahashai went in the direction of Panchavati. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. After a while, he returned to the master's room. There, on a small couch, north veranda, he witnessed an amazing sight. Sri Ramakrishna was standing still, surrounded by a few devotees, and Narendra, who later became Swami Vivekananda, was singing. M. had never heard anyone except the master sing so sweetly. When he looked at Sri Ramakrishna, he was struck with wonder, for the master stood motionless, with eyes transfixed. He seemed not even to breathe. He seemed not even to breathe. A devotee told Master Mahashai, whom he refers to as himself as M., that the master was in samadhi. M. had never seen or heard of such a thing. Silent with wonder, he thought, is it possible for a man to be so oblivious of the outer world in the consciousness of God? How deep his faith and devotion must be to bring about such a state. Narendra was singing, meditate, O my mind, on the Lord Hari, the stainless one, pure spirit through and through. How peerless is the light that in him shines. How soul-bewitching is his wondrous form. How dear he is to all his devotees, ever more beauteous in fresh, blossoming love, that shames the splendor of a million moons. Like lightning gleams the glory of his form, raising erect the hair for the very joy. The master shuddered when this last line was sung. His hair stood on end and tears of joy streamed down his cheeks. Now and then his lips parted in a smile. Was he seeing the peerless beauty of God that shames the splendor of a million moons? Was this the vision of God, the essence of spirit? How much austerity and discipline, how much faith and devotion must be necessary for such a vision? The song went on. Worship his feet in the lotus of your heart. With the mind serene and eyes made radiant with heavenly love, behold that matchless sight. Again that bewitching smile, the body motionless as before, the eyes half shut as if beholding a strange inner vision. The song drew to a close. Narendra sang the last lines. Caught in the spell of his love's ecstasy, immerse yourself forevermore, O mind, in him who is pure knowledge and pure bliss. The sight of the samadhi and the divine bliss he had witnessed left an indelible impression on M's mind. He returned home deeply moved. Now and then he could hear within himself the echo of those soul-intoxicating lines. Immerse yourself forevermore, O mind, in him who is pure knowledge and pure bliss. The next day too was a holiday for M. He arrived at Dakshineshwar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sri Ramakrishna was in his room. Narendra, Bhavanath and a few other devotees were sitting on the mat spread on the floor. They were all young men of 19 or 20. Seated on the small couch, Sri Ramakrishna was talking to them and smiling. No sooner had M entered the room than the master laughed aloud and said to the boys, there, he has come again. They all joined in the laughter. M bowed low before him and took a seat. Before this, he had saluted the master with folded hands, like one with an English education. But that day, he learnt to fall down at his feet in orthodox Hindu fashion. Presently, the master explained the cause of his laughter to the devotees. He said, a man once fed a peacock with a pill of opium at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The next day, exactly at that time, the peacock came back. It had felt the intoxication of the drug and returned just in time to have another dose. Everyone laughed. M. thought this a very apt illustration. Even at home, he had been unable to banish the thought of Sri Ramakrishna for a moment. His mind was constantly at Dakshineshwar, and he counted the minutes until he should go again. In the meantime, the master was having great fun with the boys, treating them as if they were his most intimate friends. Peals of side-splitting laughter filled the room as if it was the mart of joy. The whole thing was a revelation to him. He thought, didn't I see him only yesterday, intoxicated with God? Wasn't he swimming then in the ocean of divine love, a sight I had never seen before? And today, the same person is behaving like an ordinary man. Wasn't it he who scolded me on the first day of my coming here? Didn't he admonish me, saying, and you are a man of knowledge? Wasn't it he who said to me that God with form is as true as God without form? Didn't he tell me that God alone is real and all else illusory? Wasn't it he who advised me to live in the world unattached, like a maidservant in the rich man's house? Sri Ramakrishna was having great fun with the young devotees, and now and then he glanced at M. He noticed that M sat in silence. The master said to Ramlal, you see, he is a little advanced in years, and therefore somewhat serious. He sits quiet while the youngsters are making merry. M was then about 28 years old. The conversation drifted to Hanuman, whose picture hung on the wall in the master's room. Sri Ramakrishna said, just imagine Hanuman's state of mind. He didn't care for money, honor, creature comforts, or anything else. He longed only for God. When he was running away with the heavenly weapon that had been secreted in a crystal pillar, Mandodari began to tempt him with various fruits so that he might come down and drop the weapon. But he couldn't be tricked so easily. In reply to her persuasions, he sang this song. Am I in need of fruit? I have the fruit that makes this life fruitful indeed. Within my heart, the tree of Ram grows, bearing salvation of its fruit. Under the wish-fulfilling tree of Ram do I sit at ease, plucking whatever fruit I will. But if you speak of fruit, no beggar I. For common fruit, behold, I go leaving a bitter fruit for you. Sri Ramakrishna was singing the song. He went into samadhi. Again, the half-closed eyes and the motionless body that one sees in his photograph. Just a minute before, the devotees had been making merry in his company. Now, all eyes were riveted on him. Thus, for the second time, M saw the master in samadhi. After a long time, the master came back to ordinary consciousness. His face lighted up with a smile, and his body relaxed. His senses began to function in a normal way. He shed tears of joy as he repeated the holy name of Ram. M wondered whether this very saint was the person a few minutes earlier had been behaving like a child of five. And so here we get a glimpse of what a soul who is intoxicated with the divine is like, to be in their presence, to be around them. Mother had passed beyond such states where she would spontaneously rise up into these kind of states. There are various states of samadhi, even as the Eskimos or the Inuits might have so many names, 40 or more names for different kinds of snow, because they live in it, they survive through it. And so they distinguish between all different kinds of snow, where we have perhaps one word for it. And so in India, they have become well-versed through experience into these various states of samadhi. As Master describes, the Sabhakalpa samadhi, it's the fixed state samadhi. It is when your body becomes rigid and your eyes become fixed. It is as if you are dead to this world, but you are completely and totally alive to another. It is in this state that you become immersed in a state of bliss. Because our minds are normally bound by this body, the I idea, the ego idea, we cannot really imagine what the supreme state of consciousness is like until we have entered into it. But it is as if you have entered out into an ocean, you become that ocean. You are expansive beyond measure. You are at peace. You are in bliss. You are beyond the things of time and space. And you are completely immersed, and there is no place you would rather be. Life in the body seems now to be a dream, something that you once dreamed. Being immersed in this bliss of God, you know who you really are. You know that you have always existed, that you exist now and that you will always exist, because there is this thing that is beyond time. It sets your mind at rest. There are times when an individual will become keenly aware that this body will die, and they may get depressed. They may have different forms of reaction, but they cannot get rid of the idea that everything will end. And it puts them on to a spiritual quest, because it cannot be denied, and it's as if there is an answer, because you need an answer. You need an answer desperately. I remember as an older teenager, and this idea entered into my mind. All of these things will end. Everything that I see now will one day cease to be, and I will cease to be. What is the purpose behind this? What is the use of it? And I could not come up with an answer, but it was a question that would not leave me alone. And this is a precursor to really getting onto the spiritual path, because the things of this world no longer have the same meaning. You might do things, you might pursue things, but there's a certain kind of hollowness to it all, because none of it will last. None of it will last. And this is the beginning of wisdom, of discrimination, that this world is only temporary, that all things must pass, and therefore it cannot be the container of our eternal happiness. Now, perhaps somebody will just simply accept this idea and say, well, when that is all over, that is the end of it. But there is something deep in our spirits that doesn't like that, that doesn't accept it, that questions it. It has not yet had the experience of going beyond time and space, so it cannot say what that is. Perhaps somebody accepts a certain dogma, a certain belief, and that becomes their religion. That explains it to them. But that's not really good enough for an intelligent, questing mind. It needs to know the answer. It can't be satisfied with a mere philosophy, an acceptance of something by faith and belief. It must go beyond that. And so when we arrive at that place, that is the product, perhaps, of many lifetimes of false tries before, of having some dissatisfaction, but then finding some answer that more easily satisfies us. But now, nothing of that will do. We must pursue the answer. We must experience something that is beyond this world of time and space if we are to be satisfied. And that was my condition. And so I wandered, not aimlessly, but without a true purpose, without a true belief other than finding the answer to this question. And it wasn't until I met Mother that I felt, this is somebody who knows the truth. She has experienced that which I yearned for. And in her presence, I felt uplifted. I felt the spiritual power in her. It was not the answer to all of my questions because she spoke in ways that I didn't completely understand in the beginning. And yet, I knew that she possessed that which I sought. And so, even as Master Mahashai couldn't keep his mind off of his master, I could not keep mine off of mine. I thought of her. I kept going back as often as I could so that I might experience that upliftment. I might learn the truth that she was teaching. And it was a mighty and a great truth. It was the truth behind the scriptures, the truth particularly in our Christian scriptures that have so often been regulated into the basement, so to speak, of belief and not taken up into the bright sunshine and expansive air of true realization. It is a sad thing, really, when you read the history of the early Christian church, because those early practitioners had it. They knew what the goal was. And yet, as time progressed, those of lesser minds began to seek to spread this everywhere. And they created an article of belief, of faith, in order to spread this word. And it was now just simply good enough to have faith in the Master. But what of that? The Master came to show the way. He was a way shower. And this is something that we could not really keep from happening in this world, because the world was going into a depth. It was going into a darkness. And there wasn't anything that the world could do about it, that individuals could do, other than keep their own integrity. But God wished it so. And so in this darkness is a twilight time. And those lesser souls who are coming up through the evolutionary path, they rise up through the darkness. But they do so gradually. They come in more animalistic kind of consciousness. And so we see more animalistic kind of behavior, only it's tinted with human intelligence. The human intelligence gives it greater ability to do wrong, to do evil, than what the animal can do. So they're driven by instinct, they're driven by greed, they're driven by these things that take over the mind and with greater intelligence. And so we see wars, we see despotism, we see great cruelty. And gradually, we work our way out of those darkened ages. And in that time, we begin to see little glimmers of the truth and the light coming back into this world. And we see that with the development of science, which is painful that religion fought science because it had become something of an article of faith and belief and was no longer a science itself. And so it disputed the findings of fact, the things that could have brought greater illumination, and it actually persecuted those people who tried to bring about this greater truth. And so science led the way because it was not wanting to be limited by articles of belief and faith. It wanted to know the truth, something that should have been inspiring religion from the very beginning. But it was only through the science that many of these truths became self-evident. But then science itself has certain articles of belief. And it binds itself. It doesn't go further. And now religion must change its nature, must go past belief and faith, and into this wonderful sense of the mystery of what is true, without necessarily knowing the answers before you start. You see, religion really should be an association of people who are seekers of truth, seekers of realization, who want to know, and who are willing to do whatever it takes to get there. It is in this name that we have gathered together. I have never been interested in a philosophy or in a religion that just merely demands your faith. It is only through the experience of knowing God that we can really be satisfied on a deep soul level. This samadhi that Master Mahashaya watched, it transfixed him and those who were around him. They had never seen anything like it. It went so far beyond their philosophy. It wasn't a discussion that they were all having. They were singing a devotional song. And through the devotion that was inspired in the Master, he was lifted up into this high state of union with God. And there's a power that comes with that. There's a purity that comes with it. This is real religion. This is real spirituality. And so it puts you onto a path of something deeper and something higher. So let us, in our infancy, in our taking our toddler steps, let us not have to believe something that we have not yet experienced. Certainly we have to be able to focus the mind and train the mind in a certain direction through chanting God's name, through meditating deeply upon Him, through practicing our blessed Kriya Yoga. These are the things that take us from a focal point toward truth to immersing ourselves into that truth. Let us challenge ourselves daily to go into that truth. When you sit to meditate, don't just think, oh, I have my 30 minutes of meditation now. And then when the time is up, then, all right, I've fulfilled my goal. I've fulfilled what I've done. You're turning it into merely a ritual then. Challenge yourself. God is present with you. Even when you enter into your meditation, challenge yourself to know Him more. What have I experienced today? Have I grown spiritually through this experience? Have I known Him more deeply? And that helps you to break through the complacency of the human mind. Challenge yourself. Open yourself. You can't demand, in a sense, that God just appear to you and have it so. The timing must be right. The place must be right. And so you put yourself at the complete disposal of God. You put your whole mind upon Him, and you open yourself to the vast experience that God is. And you say to yourself today, Lord, what do you have for me? In what way might I grow in wisdom, light, serenity, peace, joy, bliss? You show me. You unfold yourself before me. And through that, let me grow in you. And that way, each day, you will grow a little more. You will experience more of God. Remember, that is the purpose for any spiritual discipline that you choose to enter into. Grow in God. Become more in Him. Until you enter into the still state. And your body may turn into something like stone while you're in that state. I've had that experience many, many times. And then gradually coming into the state of nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa means that you can operate in this world and still be in the bliss and upliftment of God. A part of you is in the all-conscious state of God. And yet you are able to move this body, to walk, to talk, to do the things that other people do. And there may be times that you are inebriated with the bliss of God in such a way that it makes you difficult for you to be able to operate in this body. But then there are other times when you are able to operate just as anybody else, and yet you are not disconnected. But in this state of nirvikalpa, there are still times when you are disconnected. Certain things come along in life, and suddenly you don't feel that bliss, upliftment, that connection with God. Because there is a state to go even further than that, and as Mother said, going over the top, and that is the Sahaja Samadhi state. As Master calls it, Brahma Nirvana. And it is the state beyond. Brahma is the creator beyond this creation. And going over the top, you now never leave that state of union with God. You can operate in every single state of human consciousness. And you are completely at the whim and the will of God. He determines what you do. And yet you want to do nothing else than be with Him. To be with Him in whatever way He chooses to express Himself through you. You have now completely surrendered yourself. You could choose to go against God's will if you really wanted to, but there's nothing inside of you that would choose such a thing. You've experienced too many times of choosing against God and the terrible consequences that that brings about. Now you only want that state. Only that state of being with God at any and all times. So let us enter in to this deeper awareness of God. It is not far from you. And grace is ever at your side, ready to help you if you would but let it and surrender yourself to it and focus your mind upon it. This is the most lovely, most powerful, most wonderful thing that can happen in our human existence and beyond it. And the most remarkable thing is we have access to it right now. We don't have to wait. We don't have to wait until we die. We don't have to wait until we gradually ascend up through astral and causal. It's all right here. And the purity of God is right here. And it is your very essence. Why would we wait even a minute? Let us immerse ourselves into the vast ocean of God and know that we are in Him and He is in us. And He is our all and all in all. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God. Victory to the light.